Hi, this is Alan Chartog. Delighted. I mean really delighted because with us today is Caroline Elsbeth Taylor, known to most of us and most of you as Kim, a professional arts manager, writer, producer, performer, and a patron of the arts for all of her adult life. And it has been an extraordinary life so far. And there's a lot more to come, but let's start at the beginning. You're an Albany girl.
Yes, I am an Albany girl and proud of it. In fact, my family on my mother's side is said to have come over, I guess, on the Mayflower and settled in Albany at some point in the 17th century. And the family made sleighs. And then eventually that they sort of segued into making the first carriages for the DeWitt Clinton, which was the first passenger train in the U.S.
Wow.
So it was called the Gould Company, G-O-O-L-D.
Has anybody ever written this history?
You know, in thinking today as I was driving over, because I live in the Berkshires, as you do, I was thinking, I really need to research this. No, not really. And in fact, my mother was always ambivalent about this, but we were direct descendants of Benedict Arnold. So she saw it as somewhat of a badge of honor because she thought he was very mistreated by, you know.
History.
History. Yes, by history.
Did she really think that?
She really did. Yeah. And she said we probably would have been Tories, which was something I remember growing up with. And when we studied the Revolutionary War, it was always, I always had a pit in my stomach, you know. But
when you went to the Albany Academy for Girls, did anybody ever raise the Benedict Arnold issue?
Well, he was vilified. Of course, we were taught that he was a traitor and that, you know, he was a bad guy.
What's a verb to be a Benedict Arnold?
I know. And so I was rather quiet about that particular part of our ancestry.
Now, how come you were direct? I mean, how did the direct work? You say you were direct descendant of Benedict Arnold.
Oh, well, that was a family lore. And I did see a family tree at one point. So, you know, you can trace it back.
There was Benny at the top.
Well, yeah.
And he ended up in England. He went back to England.
He did.
And he lived there for the rest of his life.
But hasn't there been revisionist history on, in fact, that he was treated badly?
The answer to that is there will always be revisionist history as long as somebody needs a new topic for a PhD.
Well, maybe we'll hear from some of your listeners what the latest thinking is.
Yeah, right. So anyway, hope springs eternal.
Hope springs eternal. That's right. But in any event.
So you were an Albany girl and what, at least 4, 5, 6 generations of
that's
people
right. That's right.
Went to the Albany Academy.
That's right. I think we traced it back. In fact, today I had a great-great-great-grandfather in the class of 1874. So that was Charles Barton Gould. It seems the Gould family, which was my mother's maiden name.
And what do you know about Charles Barton Gould?
I know so little. I know that his nickname was Stink Gould because he smoked a horrible pipe and I guess he smelled pretty bad.
Stink Gould.
So his nickname was Stink Gould.
Fabulous.
But he was quite a wonderful guy. He taught in the upper school. I think he taught English and history. And then his son,
Stink
John,
Jr.
Stink Jr. in 1904 started a prize that's still given at the Albany Academy for sportsmanship in honor of my great-great-great-grandfather. So.
And didn't one of your brothers win that award?
He did. My younger brother, Philip, won that. So it was a big day in my family. I remember that. I was already in college, but...
So you've always been a beautiful woman. Were you a beautiful young child?
Oh, Alan, I don't know. You know, no one thinks they're beautiful when they're a child or... A teenager, don't you think? We're also riddled with insecurity and wishing we looked like that.
And there are objective standards. I mean, if somebody looked at me, nobody would ever thought, you know, it's beautiful. But if they looked at you, I mean, throughout your life, you've accomplished so much. I used to have you on my television show, and I remember I was always very excited when you came because you were such a good interview. You would always speak well.
That's nice to hear. But I have to say one thing about having attended Albany Academy for Girls is that that wasn't important. It really wasn't. Of course, when one goes through adolescence,
sure,
you start to examine yourself and you think about your flaws, but the emphasis was really on academics, and it wasn't even that it was cool to be smart. There was no other way. Everyone strived to do really well. It was very competitive, I think, in a good sense. But I wonder sometimes, I see daughters of my friends who, it's easy to get distracted with makeup, you know, when you discover boys or you start to hit puberty and discover one's own sexuality. It can really derail, I think, especially young women.
So are you for single-sex education?
I really think it has a hugely important place. I don't think it's for everyone, but I do think that it can serve a great purpose if, for some young women, if they're really motivated and interested in academics and sports. We had a fantastic sports program way before Title IX. You know, I was captain of the field hockey. I played tennis. I learned to ski. It was a very rigorous physical education. You know, I think it was on that old Greek model of body, mind, spirit. So it was a remarkable place. And I think I was really who I am from that education.
Well, it's so interesting. I mean, your predecessors come over on the Mayflower. You go to this, I'm going to say it's a right word, exclusive school, although it does give out a lot of scholarship money and all the rest. But you end up as a very progressive liberal thinker in life. That's interesting in itself.
Well, I can really attribute a lot of that to my grandmother. And the other, when I was driving here the other day, because I still have a lot of family in the area, and my niece just had a baby at St. Peter's, so I was over here. And she lived on 187 South Main. And I spent a lot of my childhood in that house.
So it's the same house?
It's the same house. It's for sale, actually.
Been handed down.
But it's not in our family anymore. Yeah. So, but I can remember her name was Portia Fitzsimons. She was Irish, and she had red hair. White hair when I knew
her.
This
is your grandma.
Yes. And she was very passionate. I know that's a word that you like, Alan.
It is.
And one of my earliest memories was her hero in life was FDR. And there was a photo on the mantle of him. And I think it was until I was 6 or 7, I thought it was my grandfather. Because it sort of looked like pictures of my grandfather had died. And she had it on her mantle. And I knew about the New Deal and the Tennessee Valley Authority and the WPA. By the time, you know, I was in second grade, she had taught me about what it meant to be a citizen in America and a Democrat, really. She was a very staunch Democrat. And every month she would wait for her Social Security check. And she lived alone. She didn't drive. So we would walk to the bank and she would cash this check, which enabled her to stay in her house. And she was very proud. And if anyone had ever said that she was on the dole or this was, you know, Democrat or spending, you know, that kind of thing, a welfare state, she would have been just horrified and infuriated, because this was what government did. You helped people who couldn't help themselves or who needed that kind of assistance late in life. She was in her 80s.
What did Grandpa do for a living?
He was actually a poet. It wasn't a very lucrative position, but he was very dreamy, a lovely man, also, I think, politically very liberal. But he also, besides writing poetry, he had a job working to make ends meet in a garage. I know he was a kind of mechanic because it was his family that made the sleighs and then they made the passenger cars. The family story is Henry Ford asked if he wanted to go into business with him. And my grandfather said, oh, that'll never go anywhere. You know, every family has some story about that.
Funny. So Kim, they had children now, and that's how we get you.
They had one daughter, my mother.
Yeah.
But I'd spent a lot of time at my grandmother's, and so my politics, I think, were shaped by her. I don't know if people listening remember, she had a party line. Do you remember it?
Sure.
You had other people.
I had a party line. That's how old
I
am. Yeah.
I used to pick up an extension and listen to her talking to her two friends that lived on South Main, and they were both Republican. And they used to get very heated, and I liked it. I used to listen, and they'd talk about, you know, Eisenhower, and it was sort of back in that era. And then, of course, my grandmother was so crazy about John Kennedy. And we always were taught to have an opinion about politics, to be very, I think, as good citizens, educated and aware. And that upsets me today when I see a lot of younger people, just they have no opinion. Politics is sort of irrelevant. Or I have hopes that the environment, that this very discouraging and disconcerting and terribly upsetting news will draw young people in. I think that's
You're
the
referring
issue.
To the new report, which shows that we really are in trouble.
Trouble. That's already fait accompli.
Sure. We knew it. So then your grandma had a daughter. The daughter had how many children?
Three children. I have two brothers, so she had her daughter, my mother, Elizabeth, had me and two brothers.
And your father was a lawyer?
Yes. And my brother is practicing law now as we speak. And the firm is now called Hiscock and Barkley. So it's right down on State Street.
Yes. And so there were the three children.
Yes.
Did they all turn out to be Democrats?
Yes. As far as I know, I have a brother in Atlanta who's very liberal. But I think my brother, who's a lawyer, as far as I know, he and I don't talk a lot about politics. But I'm pretty sure. I think it's a pretty good assumption that he shares my views.
And the family name?
Hesburgh.
Hesburgh.
My father's name was Al Hesburgh, and he was a great running back at Yale and an All-American. So we grew up also with football, politics and football, lots of football.
I love it. I just love it. Kim Hesburgh Taylor. Okay, so let's get on with your life. You graduated from the Albany Academy for Girls, which you loved and which prepared you to hold your own in a male-dominated world.
Yes.
And then you go to college. Where do you go?
I went to Smith College. I'm not sure why. It was somewhat, it's just, I think at that age, we're also half-baked, or most of us, you know, in many ways. You sort of make these big decisions and it's almost serendipitous. But I had a friend who wanted to go, and I thought it sounded like a good idea. And I knew it had a good reputation.
It was selective.
Had a great English department.
Sure. So you go over there, and it's one of the five colleges, right?
Yes.
Now, I heard a story. I don't know if it's true. I always wanted to check it with you, that you took a course, I guess, at Amherst, and that you were mistreated. Is that story true?
Well, it is true. I decided I should take advantage of the five college area, so Smith and Amherst College and Hampshire and Mount Holyoke and University of Massachusetts. You could, you know, it was all
sure.
Interchangeable. And friends of mine said, oh, you have to have this professor at Amherst. And so I said, okay, well, it was American history, so I thought something I'm interested in. Maybe I'll learn something about Benedict Arnold. It was a very small class. I was accepted, and I went. And week after week, you know, I was very prepared, and I'd take the little bus over to Amherst from Northampton, and I'd sit there waving my hand, you know, sort of jumping up and down. And he would call on everyone in the class. And he would never call on me.
Were you the only female?
I was the only female. So I let it go for a while. And finally, it was about the fourth week. I don't know, maybe the third or fourth week. I stayed after class and I said, may I speak to you? And I said, I just want to ask, why aren't you calling on me? And he looked over his tortoiseshell glasses, put them down on the bridge of his nose, and in the most disdainful, dismissive way said, my dear, I don't have time for that.
Were you so stunned you couldn't answer?
I felt my face turning red. And I just didn't have a good rejoinder. But it was just, boy, it was like a slap in the face. I really felt that I'd been slapped, you know. So I dropped the course. And I went back and I think I talked to the dean at Smith and they let me drop it. It was pretty amazing. Just in that, it was distilled in that moment, you know, what we all encounter.
Wow, that's some story. It really is. Okay, so you major in...
English literature and art history.
Mm-hmm. What was your special interest in English literature?
English was, I'd have to say Shakespeare. And interesting because my grandmother, whom I mentioned, and her father was a Shakespearean scholar. So he was this very, I think, intimidating figure whom I never knew. My great-grandmother, my mother's grandfather. And he would apparently pace the hallways at night. He was an insomniac and recite Shakespeare. And my grandmother was named Portia. She was born in 1891, in Albany. And she was named for the Merchant of Venice. So Shakespeare also runs in our family, and I mean, the study of it, and really can't get much better than that.
So you graduate, and then what do you do?
Well, while I was in college, I took a year, I think they call it a gap year now.
Gap year.
And
usually the gap year is before you go to college.
That's right. Kind of invented it, I think, in my own way.
Yeah.
I had freshman year, and I just thought, I don't know, I don't want it to go by so fast. So I ended up working for the McGovern campaign.
Well, if it dates you, it sounds like it's yesterday to me. I don't know.
Feels like yesterday, too.
He was here one day.
Was he?
In this building, yeah.
He was a wonderful man.
Yeah.
I mean, my dad was old friends of Sergeant Shriver, who was, you know, ran as vice president. So
sure, indeed.
I think he called up and said, can my daughter do something? And I ended up on the New York State Advance team.
And what did you do?
Oh, I bought a lot of donuts. Did the early morning donut run. I had a VW Rabbit, and I used to, you know, for any event, I'd have to get the donuts and the coffee. And, you know, I was 19, so I was sent to Binghamton and Elmira and Utica, and I wasn't really the A-team. You know, I remember Jerome Kretschmer. Do you remember him?
I knew him very well, and I know him
Can
very
you
well.
Tell
let's,
your audience
let's,
who he
let's
was.
Let's leave it at that. He was a state assemblyman. He went on to be the sanitation commissioner in New York. He then bought a whole bunch of restaurants, as I remember it, in New York, and became quite a well-known restaurateur. And all of that. I knew him very well. We once shared an office.
That's fun. Well, I got assigned, I think, to his events. So in any event, that was a long time ago, but it was of course, the candidate did come to some things, and Sergeant Shriver as well, and Teddy Kennedy and all the Democrats at the time. But I really had no clue, because Watergate, we knew about Watergate. That was already, I think, being revealed. So I was sure I did door-to-door, you know, I did leafleting and canvassing. I was just so sure, how could America re-elect Richard Nixon? And it was such
a shock. Did it turn out you were a little naive?
I was completely just blindsided. Won. And I think maybe that's why I moved to Massachusetts and stayed in Massachusetts ever since. They were the only state that went for McGovern.
So, Kim Taylor, I guess the question is, how were you treated as a young, attractive woman on the campaign trail?
Well, again, it was 1972, so it was a number of years ago. And
well, we hear all of these stories about young, attractive women being hit on by older politicians. Did that ever happen to you?
Not then. Maybe along the way since then and some other campaigns. But I think I was so focused on what I was doing and almost, you know, I was very naive. But I have to say, I had some great colleagues, and I think they sort of took care of me, looked out for me. In fact, the head of the effort in New York was George McNamee. I don't know if you know him, who's still in Albany. And I was treated with a lot of respect, and I don't know, I have to say, it was a great experience.
Okay, so McGovern loses. What happened there? You want to remind everybody?
Well, I mean, everyone other than myself knew that's the way the country was heading. But after that, of course, Watergate unfolded and Nixon was impeached, and, you know, it was kind of, thin gruel. I mean, it felt somewhat some kind of a retribution, but still stings a little bit.
Yeah. And Nixon looks good compared to some of the people who are around in the same party.
Who would ever have thought we'd say that?
Environmentally and otherwise.
You know, it's true.
Yeah.
Talk about revisionist history. I know I feel very differently about him than I did in 1973, you know.
Many of us do. Mm-hmm. So take us on your career.
I went back to Smith and I finished, and I was really determined to be a journalist. And I think we called it a newspaper writer back then, newspaper man probably. You know, there weren't a lot, I hate this word, it's so overused, but role models for women back in the 60s. I mean, Gloria Steinem, who went to Smith, and Betty Friedan, who went to Smith, were just, you know, starting to know them as a culture. But I loved reading newspapers. Every day we'd get the Knickerbocker News and the Times Union. And I would read Brenda Starr, the comic. I don't know if people remember that.
Very well.
And I wanted to be Brenda Starr. That, to me, was the most glamorous, exciting woman that I knew, that I could see. You know, it didn't appeal to me. I mean, Father Knows Best or all those shows, Donna Reed, where the mom was... Which is great if that's what you want, you know, at home looking perfectly coiffed and turned out. But, you know, I just wanted this life of mystery and excitement. And, of course, she had that very exciting love interest that had a patch over his eye. Basil St. John, yes.
I know these things.
That's exactly. So I was hoping for that. I mean, that's what I... So I applied for an internship at the New York Times when I was at Smith, and I won it.
Wow.
Because Iphigenie Sulzberger, who was the matriarch of the Sulzberger family, went to Smith. And they didn't do internships, but they let me come aboard for a month or so. And it was great. I got to cover a double axe murder-suicide in New Jersey, which was pretty thrilling. And then I got to go to the Rangers locker room with a sports writer named Parton Keyes, who was one of the main sports writers. And, you know, I just kind of had run of the place, which was really thrilling. So then I was advised, get a job on a regional paper. So I went to work for the Springfield Daily News after I graduated.
Was that an easy job to get? Because right now...
No, it was tough.
Okay, so
they knew me because I had worked summers. And that was where I really got my first dose of... I think they looked at me coming from Smith and they said, we're gonna give her a run for her money. So I was sent to Enfield, Connecticut as the quote-unquote bureau chief. And I covered, you know, city council and zoning and planning and the sewer commission. And then I'd also have to cover the police blotter, which meant I covered all the night meetings. And then I'd go file my story. And then I'd still have to be up at 6 a.m. So I would sleep 3 or 4 hours a night. I think those double shifts, I think they're illegal now, aren't they, or something with
the
guild?
But you owned your job. To me, the big issue here at WAMC on newspapers. We were just talking about this with Rex Smith, who's the editor of the Times Union, which is there are two kinds of people. There are people who own their jobs. Our wonderful news director, Ian Pickus, clearly owns his job. And you know, you never have to say to him, why didn't you do this? Why do you do this? Because he owns the job. It's, he takes it personally. I know you did, too.
I did. I was so driven. It's interesting why some people are. And I
yes, it is.
Really wanted to succeed. I wanted to be hired by a bigger paper. And I have to say, I was interviewed. Then I moved to Boston and was freelancing. And, of course, I was hoping to be hired by the Boston Globe, and I was doing some writing for them. And I had an interview with the managing editor, who's long since departed this world. And, you know, he looked at me across the desk, and I had a lot of, I think, good clips, you know, good stories. And I had, by that point, had a lot under my belt. And he said, let me see your hands. And I said, what? And he said, let me see your hands. So I put my fingers, you know, put my hands in front of him. And he said, your fingernails are too clean. And I said, excuse me? And he said, no, your fingernails are too clean. I don't want to hire you. I was dumbstruck. Again, I remember that moment.
Those are the ones you remember.
it was devastating. I was 24, 25. So it was humiliating and bizarre. So instead of going, I was still freelancing, still hoping. And the Boston Symphony got my name from the arts editor at the Globe and hired me because they were looking for someone to do some writing. And it was Peter Gelb, whose father was Arthur Gelb, who was managing editor of the New York Times. And Peter, I had known Peter's dad. And Peter looked at my writing and said, yeah, I can use you to do some writing about the orchestra. So that's how I started. And I thought I would stick around for a while. And
it was the same Peter Gelb who's at the Metropolitan Opera?
He now runs the Met.
Yeah, okay.
Had a very, very storied career. So okay. I was hired by Peter.
That's great.
And a year later,
he left.
So
him you remember well.
I remember Peter taught me everything I know.
So at the Boston Symphony.
Correct.
That is such a fabled time for you. I mean, you know, talk about job ownership. Talk about being part of the guts of that organization you were. And tell us how all of that went. How was that developed?
Well, it was and is a remarkable institution, and I feel to this day so privileged that I could have played a small role and been hired. I had always loved music. My mother was very musical. My grandmother went to Eastman School of Music as one of the first women, and then she didn't graduate because she got married.
You were
she was
player.
A trained opera singer. I studied piano, and I studied music history in college, so I love music. It was just a dream walking
into
it.
And here you are at the best symphony in the world.
It was just I had to pinch myself. The first day I walked in, and our office was on the second balcony level, and Peter Gelb, I was supposed to have a meeting with Peter, and they were rehearsing the Eroica Symphony, Beethoven's third great, magnificent symphony. And it was the first movement, and that great theme swells up in the cellos. And I opened the door to the hall and just stood there with my mouth open, and I didn't know rehearsals were closed, and it was sort of not done, that you just walked in. But I was so moved, and Peter came looking for me and hauled me out of there. So I had to learn the etiquette and the protocol. I also brought a cup of coffee, I remember, once on stage, and the stage manager practically, you know, grabbed me by my collar and, don't you let me see you doing that ever again. You know, it was like, he was 6'5", and I was...
What was the name of the tuba player in the Empire Brass? The tuba player, Sam Palafian?
Yes, Sam Palafian, okay. Yes.
I once asked him in an interview that I did with him, don't you ever undermine the stage by all the spit that comes out of the... He confessed, out of the tuba, he confessed that that was the first time anybody had asked him that particular question. So your coffee couldn't have done as much damage as that. Anyway, Kim, take us on the tour. So you're there, you're excelling in this whole thing, you're having a wonderful experience. It's arguably the world's greatest orchestra, you know it, and you spent a lot of time there.
I did. Well, I'm a trustee now.
I know, trustee.
I'm happy to say
now,
so.
Now, for those people who don't know what it means to be a trustee of the Boston Symphony, Kim is going to blush. But, you know, not everybody can be a trustee. It's quite a privilege and quite an honor to have that. And you and James, your husband, have done a great deal, you know, for that orchestra. But okay, so you've there and you go up through the ranks. What's that like?
Well, Peter Gelb left about a year after he hired me, and he went to Columbia Artists Management, where he made some fabulous movies about Rostropovich and Vladimir Horowitz, his return to Russia and the concert stage, and some incredible work. And then he went on to Sony Music, and then he went on to the Met. And I say this because wherever he went, I was still working. I always did work. The Boston Symphony would sort of let me be on loan for Peter because it was all part of the family. But in any event, I was sort of, to my surprise and horror, because I had thought, of course, I'd go back to writing full time. But I sort of inherited Peter's title.
And that title was?
I think that at the time was director of promotion, director of marketing for the orchestra.
I see. Okay, great.
We didn't really say marketing back then. I think it wasn't a term, hadn't made it in Boston yet. You know, that meant going shopping at Whole Foods at that point. So I took over, and I think I was the first woman in a really senior management position. No women at all.
Interesting.
And Seiji, I had never worked with a woman.
And of course, we're talking about Seiji Ozawa.
Seiji Ozawa, obviously Japanese. And again, this was 1980, so I'm not sure he knew what to think of me, but I know that before he met me, because my nickname's Kim, he assumed I was Korean.
That's funny.
So when I finally was taken in to meet him in, you know, the dressing room, and he had his yukata, which is a kind of cotton kimono that he would wear, you know, after he would change his clothes sort of in the dressing room before he would change into his street clothes. And he said, "Funny, you don't look Korean."
That's very
so
funny.
That was my first meeting with him.
And how long before he fell in love with you?
Oh, well, he's one of the great human beings and most incredible people I could ever have worked for. So we had, a good 25 years together. And at the same time, John Williams, who's the, of course, great conductor and composer who's composed, I think, every Steven Spielberg film.
Unbelievable.
As your audience knows.
And what a gentleman.
Well, he was a Boston Pops conductor. We started the same year, so we always joke that we're the same class, you know, at the BSO. So half the year I worked for Seiji, and half the year when John would come, I would work for him. And then I also was able to work on some of his projects. He recorded one of the Raiders movies, Raiders of the Lost Ark, with the Boston Pops, The Empire Strikes Back, and then Schindler's List. We recorded in Symphony Hall with Itzhak Perlman, which was one of the most magnificent film scores, I think, of all time. Certainly one of
John's. How does he do that?
I don't know how the hell
does he do it?
Time after time.
Yeah.
And then Saving Private Ryan, we also recorded in Symphony Hall.
Yeah.
So it was also a great honor that I've gotten to know Steven Spielberg since 1980 pretty well. And he's such a wonderful human being.
And you went through a brief marriage somewhere in there, did you not?
I did. Yeah. I did, with an orchestra member, which is
right.
I only ever meet people at work, you know. So,
yeah.
And then I was working at the symphony for John Williams, and he had invited a musician for one of our television shows with PBS, and that musician was James Taylor.
Now, when was this? What can you
identify? So that was 1993.
Yeah. Now, to you, that may seem like a long time ago, but to me, it sounds like yesterday. So 1993, you meet James Taylor. And tell us how that went.
Well, you know, we were lucky with the Boston Pops. We had many great artists coming through, Aretha Franklin, and oh my gosh, I can't even think. I mean, how whoever really was many of John's friends, and we were lucky. So the producer of the program had asked if I could, I used to do this thing where I would go out on the stage of Symphony Hall and introduce whoever the guest artist was and ask people not to take, you know, flashes and not take flash pictures, not to flash.
Too early to tell them to turn off their cell phones. We didn't
have cell phones at that point. So I was very nervous about this, and I really didn't like doing that because I felt like a nerd. So I had to ask James something about his background. Was he, in fact, a native of Boston, which he is, which I didn't know. He was born in Boston.
Oh, interesting. I always thought it was North Carolina.
No, he lived in Boston for the first 6 or 7 years in Weston, which is right outside Boston.
Hmm.
So I asked him some questions, and he was so nervous because he had never performed with a symphony orchestra. And to start with John and the Pops, so that was sort of starting at the top.
Who chose him to be there?
John Williams did. Yeah. Had wanted to have James for a long time. So, you know, we both were focused on our respective responsibilities. And after the concert, we were talking. And he said, "Do you ever get to Martha's Vineyard?" And I said, "No." And afterwards, I thought, "I'm an idiot. Why did I say no?" I was just being honest. And then the next day, he called me. And he said, "By any chance, did you find a watch?" He had this beautiful, kind of a cerulean blue antique watch. And he said, "It's the only place in the world he's ever had anything stolen. All the dressing rooms, every continent or country where he's played." So I thought, wow, can't he do better than that? You know, but I went and looked for it. In fact, it was true. He really did have his watch stolen. So I called him back and said, "Sorry, we can't find it." And, you know, it was a couple of years before he called me again.
Interesting.
Just the timing wasn't right. You know how they say, timing is all. So a couple of years later,
Phone rings.
And he was coming up to Boston for one of his nephew's graduations. So we got together. And
wow.
That was that.
So how many years have you guys been together?
Well, we've been together since 1995 and married since 2001.
Right. I saw a CBS Sunday Morning in which he's talking about you. And in the most flattering, wonderful, endearing terms you could possibly imagine, saying you were it. You were his life. And it was really something to watch.
Well, he's pretty special. And it probably helped I was sitting right next to him off camera. So.
Here you've had this extraordinarily successful career. I remember interviewing you pre-James on Channel 6 in Albany and having you come in and talk and all the rest. And this has got to be, look, I'm married to a wonderful woman who has a separate career. She's an author. She's a longtime full professor and all the rest of it. But, you know, she still has to listen to all this garbage when people meet her and say, you're married to Alan Chartok, of which she doesn't think much. In other words, how does one handle that?
Well, I think, you know, it's always different. Every situation is different. But James's audience is a wonderful audience. They really are. His people who like his music and his fans.
It's unbelievable.
I feel like he's very blessed. I know he feels this.
Who would ever
hugely
forget Tanglewood when the traffic was backed up to Springfield?
I know. Well, I mean, the kind of people, that they just are very respectful.
Yeah.
Sure, they sometimes them. They are enthusiastic. But James says you can't ask people to pay attention to you all your life and then complain when they do.
Sure.
And that's kind of his MO or what he lives by when people ask for an autograph. And I do think celebrities who are nasty to people, I mean, of course, it depends on how they're approached and
sure. Sometimes
are better than others. But someone who's polite, I mean, I think it goes with the territory. And I also think for me that working in a kind of public position for many, many years was very good preparation.
Taking care of all of the major musicians,
yes,
the
Seji
and Yo-Yo and all the rest of those guys, right?
And understanding the life of a musician, I think, and a touring musician. It was really remarkable how when we came together, it really was like, I think we both feel like finding our soulmates.
Well, yes. But I never got a good answer from you about, I mean, we started this conversation talking about the Albany Academy for Girls. And you're talking about how it was instilled in you could do anything. Is that what allows you to be in this goldfish bowl now and to know who you are personally?
Wow, well, that's quite a question. But really, growing up in my family, my parents and my grandmother, who I keep going back to, I mean, it was sort of our primary purpose was doing well in school. It just was understood. There wasn't any question that we would study really hard, do our homework, be good in athletics. I did a lot of theater. I did music. It was a very well-rounded and very, I think we were all very focused on this. There wasn't much time to, I don't know, get into trouble. Or for me, it just was the right mix. It was tough. It was always...
But did that instill in Kim? Did that instill in you your ability to handle it all? I mean, you just gave this great answer and said that, you know, you were taking care of all of these musicians and being responsible mm-hmm. for them and all the rest of it. But I notice now my favorite part. There are two favorite parts I have of every JT concert I've ever been at. One of them is when you're singing backup and you're up there with the singers. I love that, and I love watching you do it. But also, there's also, and this is probably, you know, this is an interview with you, but there's that time when Arnold McCullough does his solo and everybody goes crazy. So there you are, and there he is, and those are, in addition to, of course, of all of the great James things, because when he talks to you, you feel like, well, he's talking to me, and so that's great. So how did you come to sing backup?
Well, you know, talk about a dream come true. I feel like some of the best things happened a little bit later in life for me. And I always sang, and my mom and my grandmother, I grew up again with a lot of singing in the house. And I was in the Glee Club at the Girls Academy. I was in the chorus at Smith. And I was lucky because the great Tanglewood Festival chorus does Christmas concerts.
John Oliver. Not Oliver, who's the congressman. Who is the congressman?
No, Oliver with an I. But I think he had a lapse of judgment. And I'm not, like 25 years ago, they were short some sopranos for the Christmas concerts. So I got grandfathered in so I would get to sing with them. But I think James heard my voice. He heard me singing, and he was very smart. He started very gradually. He was in the studio doing a record called Hourglass, which I think was about 1996. And I had stopped by because it was in New York and the symphony was playing at Carnegie Hall. And he said, stop by. And then he said, you know, I just want to hear what this part would sound like if you could sing, because I have a soprano that sing this part. So I thought I was just experimenting. So I did it and, you know, went on the record. sir, of course, I got a taste for it, and he created a monster. So the more he let me do it, the more, you know, of course, I wanted to. And his real singers have been wonderful to me, and I've been allowed to do this. So
he has great backup.
It's really an honor. And, I mean, who wouldn't love to do this? It's just so much fun.
What's it like being up there looking at on that massive audience?
I mean, it's just one of the coolest things ever. And you feel that great sense of energy and community and belonging. And it's just a real high. It's really remarkable. And of course, being on stage, it's interesting seeing James. It's been great because seeing him from that point of view, and I can say it, you know, as objectively as I can, he really is such a remarkable musician.
Ah.
In fact, I was a little sheepish, as one would be initially, about singing, you know, on stage with him. And it was Paul McCartney who took me aside. He came to one of James's concerts in London. It was Paul who gave James his start. James was the first artist that was chosen by McCartney and George Harrison for Apple Records. So Paul came to the concert. It was the first time he'd been in public since that kind of messy divorce he had. And he and I sat together, and it was James's one-man band, and there was a picture of the Tanglewood Festival chorus which sang with James, and I was in it, and Paul said, "Oh my gosh, that's so great." And I, of course, blushed, and he said, "Kim, no. You never feel embarrassed. You hold your head up. The greatest thing you can do is participate and be a part of what James does."
As his wife was with him, Linda.
As Linda was. He said, "Linda and I never spent a night apart." And of course, she sang with the band too. And he said, "And don't ever worry." He said, "If we worried about what people said about them, no one would ever get out of bed in the morning." So he said, "You hold your head up and you do it. If James wants you to do it, you do it and travel with him." And it's been a really wonderful thing.
Which brings us to Rufus and Henry. Who are they?
My twin boys, our twin boys, who, God help us, have just turned 13.
This is unbelievable.
So,
I mean, I remember them when they were little tiny
know.
Babies.
I can't believe I have two teenage boys. And I just was thinking it's some kind of karmic payback. You know, my parents must be laughing somewhere that I'm going to have to go through adolescence. But no, they're wonderful boys. We couldn't be more blessed.
Yeah. What's it like to be a mom to two 13-year-olds?
Well, it's so far so good. Hillary Clinton is right. It takes a village. Since I don't have my parents, we have many close friends. I have my brothers and my brother's family. I have my very close to my two nieces. And, you know, I think it takes a lot of help. And I'm very sad that we don't have more grandparents that are with us.
Sure.
Because that was such an important part of my upbringing. But we have people who take the place of that.
Yeah. What about their schooling? Is it tough? I mean, you were such an achiever. Do you project your own values onto them?
I think every parent does, don't you?
Yeah.
I try not to, but I think it's inevitable to a certain extent. And yes, I find myself wanting to push them a little. They're at another wonderful independent school called Berkshire Country Day, if I can mention that, in Lenox, Mass. And it's just another wonderful school where there's a great sense of treating each child individually. And it's a small school, so they're often in the same class, but it doesn't matter. I mean, they're treated absolutely as individuals, not as twins or a part of who they are.
I was going to ask you about that because, you know, I'm an identical twin and I'm always interested in the subject of twins and how mom treats twins, because if you treat them as a half a person, the twins, you know, that robs them of a certain amount of personal identity. And then if you say to them, you have to be different, that can create other issues.
Hmm.
So I wonder if you could give us a little bit of an insight into your philosophy of raising twins.
Gosh, I don't know if I have a philosophy. I think it's seat of our pants most of the time, it feels like. But I think I'm lucky because these boys have been so utterly different from birth, and they're not identical. They're fraternal. So Henry is really musical. I know every mom says this, but he really seems to have that going for him and loves guitar and loves singing and very athletic. Sports are his thing. And Rufus is intellectual, dreamier. And the other day, we had a friend visiting and said, "Rufus, what do you think you want to be when you grow up?" And he looked at him and he said, "A poet." And I was never
right
heard
back
him
to grandpa.
Say that. Yes, you remembered. I was just about to say, can you imagine my great-grandfather? And I have his little book of poems on my bedside table called The Dream Road. He was a published poet. So it just really stopped me in my tracks when Rufus said that, because I've never had a discussion really about it. Although he obviously knows that I write, or James is, of course, a great poet, I think. So anyway, who knows? Who knows what will happen? I just don't think one knows with kids. I think the principal role of parents is to try to let them separate. I don't know if I can encourage them to separate, but I hope I can.
You mean separate from each other or separate from you?
No, from us.
Yes,
from us.
Yeah.
And let them become their own, whoever they are, and find their way in this world. I mean, I don't know how do any of us do that. I think it's the hardest thing.
Indeed, but somehow we do.
Most of we manage, I guess, by hook or by crook.
Kim, what's next for you? I mean, what do you want to do now?
Well, you know, talking about another dream that's come true, and I know, Alan, she's a great friend of yours, Kate McGuire, who's head of the Berkshire Theater Group.
One of my favorite people in the world.
And mine, too. And the kids sort of brought us into this a few years ago. They decided, because they had a friend who had done it, to audition for A Christmas Carol at the Berkshire Theater. So James and I went with them, and we thought, oh, God, they've never done acting. They don't know what they're doing. And they were asked to read a script. And Henry was cast as Tiny Tim, and Rufus as the young Ebenezer Scrooge. And at the time, they said to me, would I like to read for Mrs. Cratchit? And I thought, God, am I old enough to be Mrs. Cratchit? Of course, I'm much older than she probably was. And Eric Hill, who's, of course, the great director and married to Kate, said, at last I have someone age-appropriate to play Mrs. Cratchit. So that was a little bit of a shock, because I was still probably thinking, I had my, you know, days of being an ingenue, because I used to do a lot of acting, and I was sort of, you know, we're going back many, many years. So I played Mrs. Cratchit, and the following year, James played Bob Cratchit, which was a great,
to put it mildly,
great fun.
Every performance was sold out.
Well, it was really great. And then Kate had the idea, and Eric, that we did a, you know, dramatic presentation of Edith Wharton's Roman Fever this past fall. And Eric did a beautiful version of it, an adaptation. So Kate and I played the two roles in that, and it was so much fun.
Well, that's interesting, because we talked about you doing backup for James, but of course Kate is married to Eric, the director. How's that play out? What's it like?
Well, you know, Kate's a very accomplished actress, although she hasn't done much. I think she doesn't have the time because she's so busy running these theater, you know, the Colonial Theater,
in
Berkshire
Pittsfield,
Theater,
yeah,
in Pittsfield.
And now they've combined, and she has a hell of a job.
But she's a wonderful actor. And so Eric thought it was a good idea in the adaptation. He could see each of us playing one of these Whartons, two female characters who are women of a certain age who go back to Rome for the first time with their grown children. And more is revealed. It's a great, great story.
What's it like to be directed? I've often wondered about the role of the director. Does he say, hold your head this way, or does he leave you alone? What happens?
Well, I think it depends. In A Christmas Carol, there wasn't as much direction because there are many characters, and you just have to get the thing up and running. But Eric Hill has he's done it many years. He's such a magnificent Scrooge. He has played that character.
Yeah.
He knows what he wants. So he's very concise. He's very articulate, you know, and the Cratchit scenes really don't take up a lot of time. I mean, they're very critical to that particular drama. But with the Edith Wharton piece, you know, it's just essentially the two of us and then also a narrator who is a wonderful young actress at BTF. But we were directed by Kira Naughton, who's the daughter of James Naughton, you know, the actor.
Indeed.
And she was fantastic. So we spent a lot of time talking about what Wharton's probably motivation, what her thoughts were about these women, what the women thought about each other. And it was great, great fun. I think it's better than seeing a shrink in a way, you know. It's a kind of therapy.
I always felt that way about college teaching, which is you get in there and all of a sudden you lose yourself and, you know, you're off in another place. So looking back, any regrets? Is there anything you see that you would have done differently?
Well, who among us doesn't have some regret? I don't have many. I wish I had spent more time with my parents because I lost
them. You're so devoted to them.
I was just in that point of my career where I was so dedicated to it and working so hard.
I'm sorry, Kim. Was there ever a moment when you were down, when you really had to rely back on mom and dad?
Of course. I mean, I knew I had them as a kind of, you know, that wonderful safety net. Although I was very proud. And when I was down, I'm not sure I wanted to admit it. You know, it was sort of in my training to be very self-reliant.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting question, but I think...
But just the fact that they were there was important.
Yes, and as examples. I really think we learn by example more than, you know, parents can tell you, can preach something or say something, but it's really who they are and how they live their lives and how they behave themselves. That's what I think children see.
Without question.
That's the people they become.
I agree with you. I agree with you. Because if I didn't agree with you, I would have to be kicking myself around the room for having not spent enough time there. But the one thing they tell me is it was important to watch what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's right. You're exactly right. Do you ever think that you would have made a good lawyer because your brother is a lawyer, your father was a lawyer?
My grandfather was a lawyer, my great-grandfather. Mm-hmm. I did think about going to law school. I did. And I think I might have been great. So I'm not sure that's a regret.
No, you would have been great, but because you're so persuasive. And the thing I love about you the most is your ability to never... You're never oppressive with anyone. It's just in their best interest to do what you're thinking. And you have that ability to make them do that. I'm sure that's what did you so well, both as a reporter in your early career at the Nick News and these other newspapers, but also fronting for the symphony. I remember one day I was on the air during a fun drive and I was yelling, "Save Tanglewood, save Tanglewood." Mm-hmm. I got this telephone call from our news director, said, "We've just had a call from, I don't remember, it was a Mark or one of the mm-hmm. people who are running the symphony and saying, will you tell them to stop saying save Tanglewood? I mean, save Tanglewood on WAMC. I mean, don't save Tanglewood." And that's the kind of fire that you were always putting out.
Well, it was a great run, no question about it. But I do think when I've had the chance to be around really some of the greatest politicians of our time, I'd look at my skill set and I'd look at the skill set that someone like Barack Obama has.
And you've spent a lot of time with Barack Obama, haven't you?
Well, I've been lucky. James and I have been lucky to
you've been
yes.
brought to the White House. You campaigned for him. You know, you've really been in that inner circle, as you have with our great governor of Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, who's
a
wonderful man.
One of the great human beings, the most, I can't say enough about him.
Yeah.
And a wonderful friend and neighbor, of course, with the house in the Berkshires. And I already feel depressed about what Massachusetts will do after November.
It can't be as good as it is now,
I don't
that's
know.
For sure.
And he and his wife, Diane, are remarkable, as are, I think, Barack Obama and Michelle. I'd like to think that history will really look back and much of what he's achieved, or he will be viewed very differently in years to come.
Without doubt. I think that's right. Tell me about Michelle. Have you spent individual quality time with her?
Yes, and James and I are a huge fans of the First Ladies. We actually went to her 50th birthday party, which was remarkable. I know without telling tales out of school, I mean, the band was Beyonce. So what more can I say? It was pretty incredible. And they're both just so magnificent. And I think they are hugely conscious in terms of the kind of role models they are to their daughters, seeing them with their daughters. They're just two of the most loveliest young women.
Is there one moment between you and Michelle that you could tell us about?
Well, we like to talk about fashion. One of the things I love, and I always feel a little guilty because I think, well, it's maybe a sort of superficial pursuit, but I love fashion, and she does too. So we always ask what each other's wearing. And I'll say, whose is that? Whose dress is that? And she'll say, this is J. Crew. Really? And I'll say, no, it's not. Or she'll ask me, and I'll say, you know, I don't know, whatever designer, Stella McCartney. And she's like, oh, I want that, you know, so it's a lot of fun. We talk about that and shoes and, you know, kind of have a girl moment.
I want you to end this whole thing with a story. It's my favorite Kim Taylor story of all. And you made the mistake of telling it to me once. I've told it on the radio myself enough times. But I want you to tell it as it happened. It has to do with one of your favorite actors on the television drama House and meeting him in a hotel in Los Angeles.
How did you know this? I don't remember telling you.
And it was probably a bad idea. But I have loved the story ever since you told me. Could you sort of
do it quickly. It's true. I'm an unabashed fan of the TV show House, which is sadly, it's in reruns, of course.
Yeah.
I think it will be forever.
Yeah.
And it starred Hugh Laurie, you know, as this
House.
Curmudgeonly and sort of, what would you say? I don't think he's
damaged.
Really a misogynist. He's not really a misogynist. He just hates
people.
All people, yeah. Anyway, we were in L.A., and we were staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, which is another story, which is another source of controversy, I understand, at the moment. But anyway, I was with a couple of friends in the what's called the Polo Lounge, which is their sort of famous restaurant. And I look over and I saw, my friend said, there's Hugh Laurie. And I said, where? You know, and she said, right over there. And I said, no, it isn't. And she said, yes, it is. So we went up by the hostess stand and we were hiding behind a potted palm. There was literally a huge palm tree. And we were trying to be very discreet and cool, you know, and look over the palm so we could see. But I could only see his face reflected in the mirror, so I could see the back of his head. Of course, the hostess came over, and we looked like two groupies. It was so humiliating because, you know, then I had to say, well, I'm actually here. I'm waiting for James Taylor. And she said, sure you are, you know, because we were staring at, you know, Hugh Laurie, so I waited for James to come, and I made James go over.
No, that's not the way I heard the story. I heard the story that you got on the cell phone because he was outside the hotel
in. That's true.
And he said, here's what you're going to do. Is that right?
I did. He was coming from the Valley.
Yeah.
Because he'd been in a recording session. And I called him because he was taking so long. And I said, okay, go to the valet, park your car, and you have to come in. Please come right in and talk to Hugh Laurie. And just because I'm afraid he's going to finish his dinner and leave.
Yeah.
But James didn't. James came and got me first.
Okay, now the way I heard the story was you called James and said, come in, introduce yourself to Hugh Laurie, and I'll be standing behind the potted palm. And
well,
and then he came in, James stuck out his hand and said, I'm James Taylor. And Hugh Laurie said, yes, you are. And, you know, and James turned around to the potted palm and said, and here's my wife, Kim.
Well, pretty much that was the story. And it turned out Hugh Laurie's a huge fan of James and was much more, I think,
and he's a musician
impressed
himself.
And surprised to meet James. He was just speechless.
Yeah.
And then he invited, this is the most exciting part, we got to go to the set of House and watch it being filmed and see the, you know, fictitious, the medical center that's supposed to be in Princeton, New Jersey, yeah, and meet the cast. And they all came to one of James's shows.
You told me once that you didn't like some parts of the program because every time you watched it, you thought you had the disease that they were talking about.
How about amyloidosis or sarcoidosis? Every single time they think that somebody has that. Have you noticed that?
Yes.
And so I've Googled them, and they're terrible diseases, and yeah, I'm sure I have both of them right now.
Now, you and I both have that.
I'm the most suggestible. It's terrible. And I love medical shows. And my new favorite is Nurse Jackie. I don't know if you are a fan.
I have not seen that
Edie
because
Falco.
I got to sleep too early. But in any case, listen, Kim Taylor, we just love you. I mean, love you. You've done so much for WAMC. You and James have been our patron saints. We're down to you and James. Pete has left us.
Oh.
And you have been so...
Well, Alan, you have it backwards. It's the other way for us. You are our patron saint. And we are huge and devoted listeners. And may it be so for many more years.
Indeed. We love you, Kim.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.